In 2012, the remains of King Richard III were discovered in a car park in Leicester. The woman behind the discovery, historian Philippa Langley, rewrote British history.
Like a Monty Python sketch.
It is, yeah.
Is she about to do it again?
I said that it was job done, but actually it wasn't job done. Did Richard III murder the princes in the tower?
For 500 years, we've believed that King Richard murdered his nephews, known as the Princes in the Tower.
But I think the princes weren't murdered. I think they actually survived.
With criminal barrister Rob Rinder by her side.
So what we're about to see is big.
This is history right here.
A continent-spanning journey awaits.
So Europe is an absolute treasure trove of information.
As they make startling discoveries.
Now comes the real treasure.
Wow, wow, wow.
It is a wow document.
And scrutinize evidence.
I don't see why anyone is satisfied with a forced confession.
This is a forgery, it's a fake. Rich III is the bad king.
Can Rob and Philippa uncover the truth?
He's either one of the greatest con men in history, or he's a king.
And crack one of the greatest mysteries in British history.
This is a smoking gun document.
The Princes in the Tower. The new evidence. London. Philippa leaves King's Cross Station.
For the last 7 years, I've been investigating the story of the two princes. Working with an army of researchers, we've made the most startling discoveries, which I believe prove what happened to the missing princes. And it's a very different story to the one in most history books.
I'm going to see the criminal barrister, Rob Rinder. He's been very successfully involved in a number of high-profile murder cases.
I want to find out if I can convince a professional skeptic that I'm right.
She gets out of a taxi.
So, Philippa, as I understand it, your view is that we need to relook at the murder of the princess in the tower. Is that the point?
That is absolutely the point, and I've spent a number of years doing this. I think very strongly that truth matters. So I went to see investigative specialists to get their advice, and they all told me the same thing. Yeah. There's actually no evidence anywhere that they were murdered. There's no identified bodies. So what you've got to do is put together a missing person inquiry. So a cold case investigation, if you like.
Now I'm intrigued.
The project is called the Missing Princes Project.
Right.
And it's not just me that's in it. I put out an SOS call asking for volunteers, and I was inundated. I've got over 300 members in the project.
300?
Yeah. I've asked people to investigate their local archives to see what they can find. I'm not telling them to ignore that and give me that. I want the lot so that I can build the jigsaw of what happened in that time, in that place, and to find facts. Things that can be corroborated.
Things that can be corroborated.
Exactly.
Now that's obviously music to my ears.
Yeah. The finds that they've made have been extraordinary. And if these finds are real, then they have the potential to rewrite history.
That's quite a significant claim.
If they are right, I think the princes weren't murdered. I think they actually survived. However, I haven't seen these discoveries. I've been told what's in them. I need a criminal forensic mind who can look at this material that I've got and evaluate it. This is why I'm here. I'd like you to come with me. You would be seeing them fresh with me for the very first time.
When you came in here, I thought you might be a bit of an activist, perhaps a crank, you know?
Yeah.
And forgive me if that sounds harsh. I'm now sitting here listening to you and I'm thinking, this is too intriguing to ignore.
After the meeting.
When Philippa arrived, I had a strong sense of who killed the princess in the tower, Richard III. By the end of that conference, I'm persuaded that on the face of it, there's enough material for an investigation.
He takes a tube.
But before I go anywhere with her, I want to get back to the original version of events to understand what that traditional, that mainstream view about what happened to those boys is.
This is Tower Hill.
So I'm off to the Tower of London to meet Tracy Borman, who's a curator there.
Domed roofs and castellations at the Tower of London.
So I'm here to learn a little bit about the Princess and the Tower.
Well, that is probably the darkest chapter in the Tower's long history, and it's still, of course, the subject of intense debate today.
We see it now here as a museum, but help me understand, paint a picture of what it was like when the princess came here in the 1480s.
It was very different. It was almost like a miniature city here at the Tower.
Stalls and traders in an animation.
There were about 1,000 people living here, working here. There were shops, there were 15 pubs.
15 pubs?
Yes, exactly.
Wow, I mean, it's crammed in here.
The Royal Armoury was here, a menagerie, effectively a zoo. It was crowded with people coming and going, quite apart from the fact it was a royal palace as well and a prison. And it's as a prison that we see it today.
Two young boys running about.
So, Tracy, who were the princes?
The princes were the sons of King Edward IV, a very popular king. But he died quite suddenly of a fever in 1483, and that plunged the country into uncertainty because his sons were only aged 12 and 9, still too young to rule. So on his deathbed, Edward IV appointed his brother, Richard of Gloucester, to be Lord Protector until his eldest son had come of age.
So their uncle brings the princes here for their protection. What's going on that they will need to be protected?
England has only just come out of what was known as the Wars of the Roses. And now this was between two warring houses, the House of York and Lancaster. The crown keeps changing hands. And it has only recently become more stable under Edward IV. And now all of that is thrown into doubt.
Edward IV left his kingdom to his eldest son, Edward V. His brother, Richard, Duke of York, was second in line to the crown. But shortly before Edward's coronation, the princes were declared illegitimate and lost their right to the throne. Their uncle, Richard III, was declared king.
An imposing stone archway.
When they first arrived in the Tower of London, they were treated honourably. They were seen playing in the gardens, shooting arrows. But then by the autumn of 1483, those boys were never seen again. And it was widely assumed at the time, and has been ever since, that they had been quietly murdered.
A leaded window.
So what evidence do you have that they were murdered?
This is an account written at the time by an Italian monk visiting London. He was called Dominic Mancini. So he talks about those two princes conducted into the more inward apartments of the tower itself, and day by day came to be observed more rarely through lattices and windows.
So who else speaks about this?
Well, somebody rather famous from the Tudor period is Thomas More, of course, a lawyer, statesman. And we think about 50 years after the disappearance of the princes, More wrote his account.
What does he actually say?
More claims that Richard III ordered the murder of his nephews. And he names names. James Tyrrell was a servant of Richard's. He was the one who organised it and employed two henchmen to carry out his dirty work. Here he describes in detail how the two murderers sort of crept in at midnight and smothered the boys with pillows hard into their mouths.
Is there any physical evidence that the boys
were murdered here.
Well, there is. In 1674, King Charles II was on the throne, and he ordered the demolition of what was left of the old royal palace here. The builders discovered, underneath a staircase, two skeletons. They were clearly skeletons of children. And the king was in no doubt. He had found the missing princes, and so those remains were buried in Westminster Abbey.
An ornate grave.
Scientists examined the bones in 1933. Their report concluded that they were the remains of two children aged about 9 and 12 years old. But the bones have never been DNA tested.
Modern science hasn't been able to take a look.
Why not?
Ultimately, it requires the permission of the sovereign. And the late queen, though asked, would never grant it. She said whoever those children were, she thought they should rest in peace.
So you think those bones are the princess in the tower?
I think there's a very strong likelihood.
Beyond reasonable doubt?
I think when it comes to the princess in the tower, there's always going to be doubt.
A portrait of Richard III.
2 years after the prince's disappearance, Richard III was killed at the Battle of Bosworth. It was the end of Yorkist rule and the start of the Tudor dynasty. Henry Tudor was crowned Henry VII.
From a painting of Henry to the rooftops of Oxford, with fields and woodlands stretching away beyond.
Philippa is taking Rob to meet an academic, who is one of the increasing number of historians starting to question the traditional account of the prince's death.
I've just been with Tracy Borman, and in a nutshell, she gave me the Thomas More account. Tyrrell did it, and we've got Mancini. Those sources, certainly according to Tracy, are pretty compelling. Why are those sources wrong?
Well, it's the old cliche, isn't it, that history is written by the victors. Henry VII did a very good job getting rid of documents of Richard III's reign, of rewriting accounts, of having documents disposed of, and he's writing his version of history, and it's the one we've inherited.
Okay, imagine I'm asking you questions in front of the jury. Mancini, right? Was he there? Is he a reliable source?
No and no. We are dealing with rumour. This isn't some official document coming out of London. This is the report of someone who barely speaks English. And it's not even conclusive. The document says that there's silence around the boys, that there's no mention of murder.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And the idea of killing a child. This is a Catholic nation. You don't kill children.
Help me then with Moore, right? He's got a culprit. He's got a suspect, Tyrrell.
We're talking 50 years down the line when we get to Moore. And we're talking an entirely different agenda, worldview. So anything he's writing is a version of events that serves him in his present day.
There's a fly in the ointment here, Janina. We're proceeding on the basis that there's no body. But there were bones discovered. And, they were buried at the time as if they were the princes in the tower.
Without DNA analysis, you cannot be that precise, say, this one's 9, this one's 12. I mean, that is a story that has been imposed on these bones, even to the point where they're named as Edward and Richard from the beginning of the report. I mean, talk about making the evidence suit your story.
If Richard III didn't kill his nephews, the princes in the tower that we've come to know, then what happened to them?
They're illegitimate. He doesn't want to commit murder, and he doesn't need to at this point. So taking these two princes somewhere else, to me, seems like the most logical situation.
Dr. Janina Ramirez, Research Fellow, Oxford University.
After taking the throne by conquest, Henry VII needed to unify the warring houses of York and Lancaster.
What does Henry do once he puts that crown on and he ends up being Henry VII?
Well, in order to stabilise England, and his position as king, he swore to marry Elizabeth of York, the prince's sister. But in order to do that, he has to re-legitimise Edward IV's children.
3 months after his coronation, Henry VII married Elizabeth of York. The marriage changed the legal position of her brothers, the princes. They were no longer illegitimate. If they had survived, they were now a threat to Henry's crown.
So then we now get a really interesting development. My research indicates that Henry went searching high and low for the princes, and he orders searches of Richard's properties and the Tower of London. But he finds nothing.
So why would he go looking for them if he was sure they were dead, is your point?
Yeah, exactly.
Why? The thing that's fascinating to me after spending time with Yanina is that Henry appears to have destroyed a lot of the evidence. So what do? Where do we go?
So we need to go to Europe. We need to find out what my research team has discovered there.
Europe? Well, why?
Henry's reach just didn't get there. So Europe is an absolute treasure trove of information.
The Princes in the Tower, the new evidence. Rob and Philippa are driving through the French countryside.
Historian Philippa Langley is taking criminal barrister Rob Rinder to examine new evidence that she believes overturns the established history that Richard III murdered the princes in the Tower.
So tell me, where are we going? You're delightful company, but I'm just slightly concerned this is a Richard III kidnapping situation.
No, trust me, you're safe. I know where I'm going. Mm-hmm. I know what I'm going to be showing you.
Yeah.
But I'm not telling you.
Lille, France.
The royal brothers had extended family in positions of power across Europe, making the archives of cities like Lille a logical place for Philippa's research team to investigate.
Can I introduce you to Rob Rinder?
Yes, of course.
Rob, this is Natalie Nyman.
Hi. Lovely to meet you. Yes. So how did you end up in this community doing this?
Well, I think it was my love for history and combined with my legal background as a criminal lawyer.
Yeah, you give me a lawyer just to throw me
off. Well, I thought it'd make you feel at home, right?
Natalie has spent the last 7 years combing through archives across Europe.
When we found these documents, we can't believe what we read. It was a completely shocking moment.
I know a bit about what's coming, but I've not seen the real thing. And I've been waiting for this for a long time.
This is a lot of promise for a document, Natalie.
It is.
And Philippa, I hope it's not going to under-deliver.
Here it is.
Hi. You seem to be very excited.
Wow, here it is.
Gosh.
Handwritten text.
This is incredible to see it. Yeah. I mean, this is history right here. Yeah,
it is.
It's remarkable.
It's more than 500 years old.
I can feel your excitement, both of you, but what am I looking at?
No. Well, you are looking at a receipt from the year 4087 for King Maximilian.
Who's that?
King of the Holy Roman Empire.
King Maximilian was the head of the powerful Holy Roman Empire, which controlled vast swathes of what is now modern Europe.
And this is a receipt for what?
He ordered 400 long pikes. And it was used by Maximilian's elite troops.
In 1487, a Yorkist army invaded England. Most historians believe the attack was led by an imposter backed by European royalty, like King Maximilian.
Okay, so why is this important?
The receipt says, in medieval French, these pikes were to be distributed among the German-Swiss pikemen whom Madame the Dowager sent at that time to serve her nephew, son of King Edward, who was expelled from his dominion. This document is really important because it's telling us that the force for 1487 that was going to invade England was for the son of King Edward IV, the elder prince in the Tower.
Have you ever seen any reference to, well, the boy being alive before, like
no,
this?
No, that's why it's so unique.
We never ever thought, did we, that something like this would exist. And yet here it is in a simple accounting record, filed away under loads of other records, just lost, just literally slotted in there.
Madame the Dowager. Now, who's that referring to?
This is referring to Margaret of York, also known as Margaret of Burgundy. And she's the sister of Richard III and Edward IV.
So she's the prince's aunt?
She's the prince's aunt. Hugely important in this story.
Well, just to be clear, it means that Margaret of Burgundy, who is Edward's aunt, is buying these weapons because she believes for sure that the boy definitely her nephew.
Yes.
But the document doesn't actually name the elder prince, it just says her nephew. So it could have been the younger prince, no?
It must have been the elder boy, because he was about 16.
It says, expelled from his dominion, which suggests the elder brother, because he would have been crowned king.
Right description, her nephew and son of King Edward. So you've got four pointers there to tell us who this was.
How is it conclusive?
It's not a chronicle. It's not somebody writing afterwards. It's just an accounting receipt.
Right, this isn't from a historian. There's no bias here. It's just ordering goods.
Yeah.
And people don't order goods like this unless they're confident about who it's for.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's why it's persuasive. So who signs or who gives their stamp on this document?
It's signed by not just one secretary for Maximilian, but then he gets it double-checked by two other leading members of Maximilian's court. So they are saying this is accurate.
And these three men that work for Maximilian believed that this was the older of the boys.
Yeah, and it's very specific wording, and these are very high court officials.
Spires and apartment blocks rising above the rooftops of the city. Then Rob standing outside the archive building, looking thoughtful.
I can really understand Natalie and, of course, Philippa's excitement. Here we have a document which mentions one of the princes. This document, on the face of it, is proof of life. And what's more, it's written by an accountant, not a historian, not any person that's got any bias. That's the excitement. On the other hand, who is this Margaret of Burgundy? What motivations might she have had to invade England?
Mechelen, Belgium. From a cobbled square to a woman's portrait. Then the city marked on a map.
The prince's aunt and Richard III's sister, Margaret of Burgundy, was one of the most powerful women in medieval Europe. Back in the 1480s, Mechelen was a busy city and the center of her power. Philippa has brought Rob to meet a historian to find out why Margaret may have supported an invasion.
What was she, like?
So she's a very visible figure. She's probably nearly 6 foot tall, and she's very, very intelligent, very well educated.
So who is Margaret of Burgundy to King Maximilian?
He is her stepson-in-law, so it's not the closest of relationships, but Maximilian very much relies on Margaret's counsel. In Burgundy, she's absolutely beloved. Everyone likes her. Maximilian loves her. The people who serve her seem to have really liked her. Even foreign rulers seem to have really liked her. Nobody has a bad word to say about Margaret. And then we get the English sources. Henry VII, Henry Tudor, calls her the Diabolical Duchess. There's another Tudor source that says she's like a dog returning to her old vomit.
Oh, my God.
It's like we're looking at a different woman, an entirely different woman.
You're saying is that it's really the Henry Tudor court, perhaps him himself and his historians, that paint this picture of Margaret of Burgundy. But if you go to the sources here, we get a totally different picture of her.
And I think that's really the point. We are very much seeing a Margaret that has been constructed in a negative sense in the English sources.
Her brother Richard, who is killed by Henry VII. Do we know how she felt about that and towards Henry VII?
She absolutely loathes Henry. She draws Yorkists to her, really just by virtue of who she is. She is the last remaining Yorkist in an independent and prominent position.
But she's trying to get back the throne for the Yorkists. Would you say that?
Absolutely. She is undoubtedly no friend of Henry Tudor. If she can work towards putting someone else on the throne, and I think it's clear that Margaret absolutely would do that.
Dr. Elizabeth Norton, Tudor historian.
It sounds like Margaret had the motivation and the means to help support an invasion. But the critical question remains, Is one receipt for weapons for a son of Edward IV enough to be confident that they survive? And was it the elder prince or an imposter who was preparing to fight for the crown?
Philip, I'm just thinking back to that receipt, and I'm really curious about Edward. If that really was him, where's he been living all this time?
I found a lot of smaller references that suggest he was in the north of England, that he got sent to the Channel Islands, and I also think that he spent some time with Margaret.
This receipt for weapons and the support from Maximilian and from Margaret, where's this all leading to?
Well, by this time, he was 16. And thanks to Henry VII, he was no longer a bastard, so he could claim the throne. And I think the evidence suggests that he was amassing an army to invade England.
The Princes in the Tower, the new evidence. The Princes in the Tower, the new evidence. Waterfront properties and boats on moorings in Dublin, Ireland.
The first Yorkist fleet, backed by European royalty, set sail for Ireland in the spring of 1487.
This is where the fleet arrived from Holland. And also you had the English rebels arriving as well. So you have this massive convergence happening,
all gathered for one purpose, to seize the crown from Henry Tudor and put a Yorkist on the throne.
Bustling city streets.
Based on the new findings, Philippa believes the invasion's leader was Edward, the older prince. Traditional history tells us the force was headed by Lambert Simnel, a 10-year-old boy pretending to be a Yorkist heir. Philippa's taken Rob to meet a historian, who, like her, questions the established story.
Hi, Matt. Can I introduce you to Rob Rinder?
Hi, how do you do?
Rob, I'm Matt.
Nice to meet you.
Welcome.
Matt is the chairman of the Richard III Society.
All right.
Welcome to Dublin Cathedral.
Historian Matt Lewis.
I think one of the most interesting and important events in late medieval history took place here on the 27th of May, 1487. My reading of the evidence is that the elder of the princes in the tower, Edward, came here to undergo a coronation. I believe all of that Lambert Simnel business is big smoke and mirrors thrown up around what would have been a hugely threatening moment for Henry VII.
Matt, what's your evidence for believing that this was the coronation of the older of the princes in the tower?
So one of the people who's here for the coronation is a guy called John de la Pole, who is the Earl of Lincoln. He is another cousin to the princes in the tower. He's the senior Yorkist heir. He's considered next in line to the throne. So if you want someone to champion, to replace Henry VII on the throne, John de la Pole is the man you would go to. But he comes here to attend this coronation for Edward.
An image of Edward and his crown.
So what you believed happened here was that a 16 and a half year old Prince Edward was sitting here being crowned by, well, significant members of the church and the Irish nobility and others who showed up in force. And it's only later that they've said it was actually a 10-year-old and it's all made up.
That's what I believe. Yeah. It was a huge political moment, but a huge spiritual moment. Nobody would undertake that ceremony lightly, and no one would want to do that to the 10-year-old boy from Oxford.
A sketch of the crowned child on a man's shoulders.
Clearly, there was a boy crowned here. They went through a ceremony, a religious ceremony. Whether or not that means that that's one of the boys in the tower, I'm not yet confident about. But applying my dispassionate mind, that's certainly some evidence that the older boy, Edward, that prince in the tower, could have been the person that they crowned here.
Traffic on London's Tower Bridge.
There's no doubt that there was a coronation in Dublin. Philippa believes the ceremony was for Edward V, the older of the princes in the tower. The established story is rather different. Rob's in London to find out more.
So Nathan,
As I understand it from Matt, the coronation was for Edward V, the oldest of the boys in the tower, the son of Edward IV. He lives, and that's why they're there. Are they right?
I would have to contradict Matt's version of events. The conspiracy taking place in Dublin was not about Edward V. It was about his younger cousin, Edward, the Earl of Warwick.
So in a nutshell, Lambert Simnel was impersonating not Edward V, but his younger cousin, another Edward, the Earl of Warwick.
Exactly.
But I've got to put it to you, Nathan, an armada of ships show up to attend this coronation from across Europe. There are noblemen, as well as churchmen, that are there to see a prince crowned.
Half of his support are the Irish. Ireland during the 15th century was a staunchly Yorkist isle. So I can fully believe that the Irish believe what they've been told by the conspiracy's leaders, that this boy truly is the House of York. That answers why they would do this coronation before God. On the other half of this armada, they're simple German mercenaries. They are following the coin.
So they're just paid soldiers?
They're just paid soldiers, sent over from the Low Countries to make an easy living.
Nathan Armin, Tudor historian.
On the one hand, I listen to Nathan, and that's a traditional view of history, and what he has to say is pretty compelling. But then you're alongside Philippa, and you imagine those people attending that coronation. And that's also pretty compelling as well. Throw in that receipt for weapons in Lille that says a son of Edward IV. It's very difficult to know where you land. And at the moment, I've got to be clear, I'm not sure.
Rob treads a covered walkway between two elegant colonnades. Then a solitary car drives along a country road flanked by fields. Stoke.
A week after the Dublin coronation, the first Yorkist fleet invaded England. Matt, Philippa and Rob have come to the field where Philippa believes the elder prince fought to regain the throne.
Welcome to the site of the Battle of Stoke in 1487. This was the site of the last pitched battle of the Wars of the Roses, that kind of 30-odd year fight for the crown of England. Thousands of men crowded this field. Many of them travelled huge distances to be here, and many of them would never walk off this field alive.
It's really humbling to think about all the men who died here.
Now, the question is it Edward or some person called Lambert Simnel?
That is the big question. If I'm a mercenary, a professional soldier, I might start laughing when someone says, we want you to follow this 10-year-old boy into battle.
And are they going to show up for somebody called Lambert Simnel?
Would you?
No.
They gaze across the vast field.
So what's the outcome? What happens? How does it play out?
We know that they clash. There is a huge confrontation. And I think this is where Edward's army struggles against its own makeup. There are disparate amounts of Flemish soldiers, Swiss and German mercenaries, Irish cairns, also some Englishmen who have joined the force. They're just so smashed together.
They're a bad team.
They were just a bad team, badly organised, and they end up being routed. One source talks about the field being littered with bodies that were pricked like hedgehogs with arrows after the battle.
This really is like a scene from Game of Thrones or something.
It is. It would have been horrific to see what was happening there.
But then there's this name at the centre of it, Edward. What happened to him?
We don't know. This is the frustrating part. We don't have a record of what happened to him after that.
What did the sources written by Henry VII, Henry Tudor, say about what happened to the person that led this army?
They're at great pains to tell us the story of this 10-year-old who is found to be named Lambert Simnel. He is pardoned by Henry and he puts him to work in the royal kitchens.
So much of this doesn't make sense. It's really hard to find clarity.
This is the original history being written by the winners. Henry has won the Battle of Stoke Field. He's kept his throne. He now gets to tell the story. And I think what he does is he creates this kind of template for a way to deal with a threat like this. And a story is constructed around this figure who was never the leader of that force. Because if Edward V is here and has either died here or has survived this battle, Henry can't admit that. He can't admit that a crowned king of the House of York has just invaded his kingdom, because it would likely cost him his throne.
Either way, the older of the princes is now out of commission, no longer a threat.
But if Henry VII has just faced the greatest threat of his reign so far in 1487 from a prince who was 16 and a half years old, he knows that prince has a brother who is 2 or 3 years younger than him. So he's going to have to think, am I going to face the same problem in a few years' time?
Thank you, Matt.
Good luck with the rest of your investigation.
Thank you so much. So that could be some total imposter called Lambert Simnel, or the real Edward V dies on that battlefield. Either way, the trail goes cold. So what happens to Richard, his brother, the younger of the princes in the tower?
We have to go back to Europe now to pick up that trail.
The Princes in the Tower, the new evidence. The Princes in the Tower, the new evidence. Arnhem, Holland.
So, Philippa, we're back in Holland. We're now trying to find out what happened to Richard, the younger of the princes.
Well, brace yourself, because we're going to another archive. We're going to meet Natalie, and she's made the most extraordinary discovery.
Have you seen it?
I know about it. I haven't seen it. But I think it's absolutely mind-blowing.
A wind turbine, then a meeting with Natalie from the Dutch Research Group.
So what we're about to see is big.
Just tell him what it was like for you when you found it.
Well, I got goosebumps because it was so special, and I never had find anything like this before.
And also, we both couldn't believe it at first.
No, we couldn't. Yeah. We had to go over it and over it and over it again to say, okay, this is real.
How long were you in the archive before you found this?
I was already 4 years searching.
Four years?
Yeah.
So intensively searching, this document is like a needle in a haystack.
Yes.
Archivist Irene Rooker.
Right.
So I've got the document here for you.
Okay, what is it?
Rob, you are looking at Richard, the younger prince in the tower's own story. A sort of witness statement in his own words.
Wow. Where's this from, this document?
Someone actually found it in the 1950s, but they dismissed it, and it was quickly forgotten about.
It was in our archive of loose acquisitions, which is an archive of documents that don't really belong in a collection. So we don't know anything about its provenance. We don't know where it's from.
What about a date or anything like that?
And it seems to be made between 1450, 1500.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this is within the period 1450 to 1500, slap bang in the middle.
Spot on.
Yeah.
Right. But having read it, you think this is his voice?
This is his voice. It's written in the first person.
I.
Yes, and we think that the original would have been written in Latin or French, but this is a copy in Middle Dutch.
It looks like double Dutch to me. I can't read it at all.
I made a transcription.
Here we go.
Okay.
I was brought to my brother, who was already there in the Tower of London.
Then what happens?
Then what happens is we were separated. I was secretly taken into a room in a place where the lions are kept. Lord Howard came to me and encouraged me. At last, he ordered the guards to leave and then brought two other men to me. They were called Henry Percy and Thomas Percy. They swore by honor and oath to hide me secretly until certain years were passed.
You've checked these guys?
I've checked out all of these guys.
And they were there at the time?
They were there.
They were in Richard's inner circle. They would have been close to the princes. It adds to the credibility and the reliability of the whole narrative.
So whoever's reporting this has to know these people, these names.
Yes.
We don't know what happened to Edward at this point because they've been separated. But as far as Richard is concerned, the Percys are going to take care of him.
Guard.
Yeah.
Then what happens?
Then they shaved my hair and put a poor and drab skirt on me. And we went to St. Catherine's. St. Catherine's is a dockyard. There they took a boat and sailed to the sea and came ashore in the dunes of Boulogne-sur-Mer.
The journey in an animation.
From here, Richard stayed in Paris, and he goes on to tell us that he then traveled across Europe to various cities before being sailed to Portugal. Shortly afterwards, Henry Percy became ill with the plague. He told me that when he died, I would have to travel to Ireland. Then he died. May God save his soul. So Richard says that he then sailed to Ireland, where several Irish lords recognized him and accepted him for who he was.
So the people in Ireland acknowledge him as Richard, the second of the princes in the Tower, straight away?
Yes.
What happens next, Philippa?
Right, OK, so what happens next? I left and went to my dearest aunt, the Duchess of Burgundy, and by the grace of God, in a short time, I will obtain my right to which I was born.
OK, yeah. Let me just... Yeah. Because this is way more significant than I was expecting. This is a story of roughly how many years, do we think?
Ten years.
Yeah. 1483 to 1493.
OK.
Key years. So if Richard was alive in 1493, he would have been 20 years old.
Could this be the writing of somebody who is faking a life story?
If this is somebody who's trying to be the younger prince in the Tower, you make it very general. But he's going into detail after detail after detail.
You see, you're present at a rare moment, both of you, me being mildly speechless.
That is a rare moment.
Well. So first, we deal in documents as lawyers, and if I saw this statement, it would be a critical break in the case. You know, this is a smoking gun document, there's no doubt about it. But I have to be skeptical. I can't just look at this and go, wow, although it is a wow document. Yeah. It is truly something.
Rob and Philippa drive on.
Philippa's convinced that the discovery strongly supports her theory that Richard, the younger prince, survived the Tower. She's brought Rob to Belgium to assess further evidence gathered by her team, which they believe supports this.
They visit stone ruins in Banff, Belgium.
Oh, gosh, Myth. Wow.
Zoe Mauler, Dutch Research Group.
So, Zoe, this is a ruin of where exactly?
This is the ruin of the palace of Margaret of Burgundy.
This is her palace?
Yes. She lived here in retirement.
But it must have been pretty splendid at the time. I mean, she was loaded. She was very rich.
Yes. And if you just look to the right, you see an arch, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's actually called Richard's room.
Well, which Richard?
It's the younger prince in the Tower. We think that he stayed here, and she names a special room after him, Richard's room, which is there.
How do you know this?
Well, actually, the account books state that after renovating the palace, it's actually called Richard's room.
And I think what is lovely about this is by this point, when she's renovating this in 1496, the timing is absolutely spot on for the younger prince in the Tower.
What's he doing here with Margaret, you know, in her retirement castle?
Well, it's a really important moment because Margaret of Burgundy is pulling all of her resources and all of Maximilian's resources behind Richard to support him, making his push for the throne.
So, Zoe, how do we know that it was him?
Richard showed people three marks on his body that couldn't be faked.
Three physical signs. What were they?
One was his eye, his mouth, and a mark on his thigh.
So what's the evidence for these three marks?
Quite by chance, I found a document in the Austrian State Archive. So if you look here, the document is about Maximilian's meeting with Richard And it states the reasons why Maximilian decided to give his support and his favor to Richard.
Who's written this account?
It is written by one of his French scribes present at the meeting.
What, when Richard, the possible prince, meets Maximilian?
Yes, presents himself.
Okay, so it's quite important evidence.
This is really important evidence.
Yeah, we have a transcription here of the documents.
And it says, "My Lord, the Duke of York, offers to present himself and show several signs by which those who knew him would recognize him, especially three natural marks which he has on his body and which cannot be counterfeited. That is, his mouth, one of his eyes, and a mark he has on his thigh."
So there's evidence that Maximilian meets this boy, this person, and he's able to show three birthmarks, which only Richard, the younger of the boys in the tower, could have had.
Could have had. And that comes from Maximilian's court at the right time for Richard, Duke of York, the younger prince in the tower.
A bird's eye view of the ruined palace, encircled by high stone walls. Then Rob sipping a hot drink as he looks out through a large and ornate circular window in a period building.
My mind's a washing machine of stuff. I've been following Richard, the younger prince's story, and there have been two really big bombshell documents.
He packs a bag.
There may be proof of life here. But the difficulty is, you know, I have to acknowledge that I learned my history in England, in the UK, right? And Rich III is the bad king. He killed the boys. But I'm aware of that. So every time I'm looking at a document, the most important thing I have to do is step back and imagine I know none of it. That's so essential. But the reality is that's really hard. It's a difficult thing not to bring your bias to a document. But I have to say, there's definitely a lot here. Way, way, way more than I thought.
The Princes in the Tower, the new evidence. Philippa looks out across a river in Dresden, Germany.
For 7 years, Philippa's team have been searching for documents that might shed light on what happened to the princes in the tower. Today, Philippa is on her way to the state archive in the medieval city of Dresden, once a significant part of the Holy Roman Empire. Her team has found a document which she hopes will add weight to her theory that the younger prince survived the tower and was now working to win the crown.
I haven't seen it. Rob can't come, so I'm going to be calling him about it from the archive. And I'm getting really excited.
A glass-roofed atrium.
She's meeting an expert in medieval manuscripts who has analyzed the document.
So, do you want to see it?
Please.
It's a really lovely document. Now comes the real treasure. The seals. You see, 1493.
Wearing a glove, she opens the document.
We unfold it. And here we go. Isn't it lovely?
I can't believe this. I mean, this is just wow, wow, wow.
So at the bottom, you have the signature?
Yeah, I can see Richard of England. I can see his monogram.
Yeah.
That's really special. I've never seen that before. Oh, look at that. Richard of England. Oh, wow.
Philippa examines the seal.
That royal seal is just incredible. And even the little R at the bottom, the royal R. But what's really fascinating is it's the closed crown of a king. That's what this is depicting. And it's the royal arms of England. I mean, this is telling me it's a king.
It's, it's blowing my mind. It's just
I'm actually shaking. So, Enrique, this is a really extraordinary document, but can you tell me more about what it actually says?
So this is Richard, Duke of York, son of King Edward IV, pledging 30,000 florins to Duke Albert of Saxony for support in regaining the throne of England. If he
how much?
30,000 florins to be paid within 3 months once he has got the throne of England.
Hi, dearest travel mate. I'm in the archive in Dresden with Henrika. We are looking at this most incredible document. I'm actually shaking at the moment, and I just wish you were here to see it.
What have you found?
It's a pledge for 30,000 florins from Richard of England, the younger prince, to give to Albert of Saxony within 3 months of him becoming king. I mean, can we show Rob, Henrika?
Let's have a look.
Yeah, I don't know if you can see this, but the royal seal here, there's a beautiful intact royal seal. And right at the bottom, there's a tiny little royal R.
That is extraordinary. 30,000 florins, a lot of money back then. What are we talking?
It's difficult to specify exactly, but for comparison, it's the GDP of a medieval city or a castle or something like that.
You have to have some, there's no nice way of putting it, balls to go and promise that sort of sum unless you were pretty sure you were able to deliver on it.
Yeah, 100%.
So how do we know that this is Richard, the younger of the princes and the boys in the tower? How do we know it's his signature?
So Rob, let me just read you how the document begins, what it says. It says, Richard, by the grace of God, Duke of York, son and heir of our most revered lord and father, Edward IV, late King of England and France and Lord of Ireland. So he's making very clear this is definitely the younger prince in the tower.
I mean, well, that couldn't be clearer, really, could it? But what about the signature itself? Can you help me a little bit with that and the writing?
It's a confident hand, obviously a contemporary hand, so what we can be fairly sure of is the charter is authentic, whoever signed it, but it's from that time and place it claims to be. And it's signed 4th of October, 1493.
Okay. So this is, just to be clear, a confident hand. So that helps us understand this is somebody who really was sure about their identity. It's probably the hand of somebody who's English. Okay, that's very important. Thank you. Philippa, you look so happy.
I am. I'm in seventh heaven at the moment. I just wish you were here. Thanks, sweetie. Bye. Bye, bye, bye.
After the video call with Rob and her meeting with Professor Henrika Lahnemann from the Freiburg Institute for Advanced Studies, Philippa travels to Zeeland in Holland. Joining her there, Rob has a shave in his hotel room.
This is the first time I've seen Philippa since her Dresden moment, our Dresden moment. I'm actually looking forward to seeing her again. We're going to go and meet and hopefully have a nice breakfast. I need a coffee. Good morning.
Morning. How are you doing today?
How was Germany?
Oh, man. It was just wild. To see that in the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
To see that seal. Oh, it was just, it was perfect. It's like it had just been made yesterday. You don't expect things like that to be found, you know what I mean?
So, with all of these documents, which I have to say, on the face of them, they're slam dunk.
Yeah.
Right? They are really powerful, really exciting kind of proof of life documents, especially for Richard.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, you've still got people who are there with other reasons why they might support somebody who isn't Richard to get rid of Henry VII. I've got to be really thoughtful about what's happening, why Margaret might have supported somebody else, why she wanted to believe that this person
was her nephew. Why it might not have mattered, because ultimately she wants to avenge her brother and at the same time damn well put someone else on the throne who is a Yorkist or a Yorkist sympathizer. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, but then they're blowing fortunes on this person. The other thing you have to remember was just 7 years before this, they put another total fortune into the first invasion fleet, right? And they got none of that back.
Right.
It just went. Right. So to invest that amount of money, time, energy, they just wouldn't do it if they didn't believe this person was of royal blood and this person was going to be the next King of England and had the proper claim to the throne.
Right.
It's huge amounts of money.
Later, they approach a wide, sandy beach, sharing an umbrella.
When you said you were bringing me to the beach, I thought perhaps I could bring some sun cream. It's blooming raining it down. It's so bleak.
With the new finds suggesting that the man calling himself Richard, Duke of York, was raising funds to assemble an army, Philippa's team has discovered more evidence that points to his next move.
We found new sources. It says that Richard, Duke of York, assembled his fleet here in Zealand.
Okay. So Richard, Duke of York, we mean the younger of the princes.
The younger of the princes. He assembled his fleet here for plans to invade England. However, Henry spies got wind of Richard assembling his fleet, so they need to make plans to remove their fleet.
The Yorkist fleet is here.
Yeah.
They realize that Henry VII has got wind of what they're doing. So then the fleet disperses. Where does it go in Holland?
Well, and that's the interesting thing. His fleet went up north. They moved their ships secretly by night, one for one, so that Henry's ships couldn't notice that he was leaving Zealand to a remote island of Texel.
Okay, what's the second piece of evidence?
We found in the domain's accounts in the National Archive in Den Haag the source about this journey. We saw accounts about messengers, about food, about secret letters, about men, soldiers, to buy ships for the invasion.
With a second Yorkist invasion of England imminent, Henry VII dismisses the leader as another imposter.
Other than the name Richard, Duke of York, the younger of the princes in the Tower, neither of you have seen any other name?
None.
Nothing.
Only referring to the Duke of York.
The case for Richard surviving the Tower, you know, is really gathering pace in my mind. There's consistent documentation referring to him by name. There's a large amount of money being raised on his behalf, and he's preparing to regain the throne of England by force. But here's the thing, can it be believed? No, that's the problem with history. How do you separate a story from the truth?
A fleet of ships in an animation.
It's 1495. The man Philippa believes is Richard, Duke of York, launches his first attack on England. But the invasion fails, and he takes refuge with King James IV in Scotland. King James treats him as an equal and finds him a wife, a royal cousin. But Henry VII's allies and spies at the Scottish court are briefing officials that the man called Richard is actually an imposter. Two more invasions are launched, but eventually the army's leader is captured by Henry VII in 1497. He's then taken to London.
The Tower of London, nestled amongst buildings and landmarks along the River Thames. Then Rob and Philippa within its high stone walls, where they meet with Dr. Anne Rowe, author of Perkin.
So, Rob, we're in the Tower.
It was only a matter of time for you, Philippa, let's face it.
Philippa and Rob
are meeting a writer and medieval historian who has spent years investigating the life of the alleged imposter.
Now, Henry's finally got his prize, Richard. He's caught him.
Yes.
So I assume, Sally, bearing in mind it's the third time Richard's tried to invade the realm, that Henry just immediately, well, has him executed, no?
No, far from it. He's always wanted to see this chap alive. He's wanted to talk to him. The next thing he does is he faces him with a confession that's already been drawn up over years by Henry's spies, and he gets him to sign it.
He signs a confession?
Yes.
What name does he give?
He gives Perry Osbeck, which is a Flemish version of Perkin Warbeck.
The official confession states that the name of the man captured by Henry is a pretender called Perkin Warbeck, a boatman's son from Tournai in Flanders.
So he gets him to sign a confession that's pre-prepared. What happens then?
His treatment of Perkin Richard is extraordinary. He isn't shackled or bound at all. He's still robed as far as we know. He goes to Westminster Hall, and there it's said he just strolled into the hall arm in arm with an officer of the court. Not chained, not in any way presented as a prisoner.
This feels totally bonkers. You know, the traditional view of medieval kings, including Richard III, is when you've got someone in your way, you kill them, including your own nephews. Here, we have Henry, who captures Richard, or Perkin, who's tried to take his throne at least three times, and he doesn't execute him, he treats him like one of the family.
Yeah, because for several European monarchs, he is one of the family. You have people like Maximilian writing to him and saying, if you kill this man, you will have killed your brother-in-law.
And as long as he promises to beat Perkin Warbeck, what's the deal?
He gets his own tailor, he gets his own horse. He's not kept in any sort of confinement. He's allowed to see his wife, and she never requests a divorce, and Henry doesn't make her divorce, although one of the few reasons to get divorced in the Catholic Church is fraud. If your husband's a fraud.
After months of special treatment, the man now called Perkin Warbeck escapes, but is quickly recaptured.
This time Henry has lost patience and he's sent to the Tower.
An animation.
Now he's in a dungeon. He's shackled and he's tortured. And we know this from the Spanish ambassador who goes to see him and says he's disfigurada, i.e. he's had his face broken.
Was he just left there to rot? What happened?
There was a plot made up that he had decided to blow up the Tower. He's charged with treason.
What happened to him after the trial? Is he found guilty?
Yes. And then he's sent for execution. But he does not have the traitor's death. He has a nobleman's death, in fact. The sentence for treason is to be hung, drawn, and quartered.
Yes.
But he is only hung.
And do you think Henry thought this was Perkin Warbeck or the younger of the boys in the Tower?
I think he didn't know who he was.
And we don't know this story. We don't learn it because we learn the Tudor narrative, right?
Yes, we're satisfied with the Tudor narrative, and I don't see why anyone is satisfied with a forced confession or a confession that's cobbled together by other people and somebody is forced to sign. If it happened today, you wouldn't accept it.
This is an extraordinary story, an extraordinary life. He's either one of the greatest con men in history, or he's a king.
High-rise buildings standing tall against the sky as night falls. Then Rob walking the sunlit streets of Oxford.
Rob is back in Oxford to see Dr. Yanina Ramirez.
I've travelled across the UK and what feels like most of Europe. Being alongside Philippa is, without question, you know, fun, and there's lots of compelling evidence, but I need another expert who's not so close to the material to give me an independent view. I think that really matters to how I'm going to conclude this case. I need some help. I've got to sort of come to some conclusions about some of the discoveries that Philippa's research group have made, and it's really hard not to get swept up in it. Yeah. But, you know, my job is to be dispassionate and make sure the evidence all adds up.
Yeah. New evidence arises in our field all the time. Mm. And whenever I'm presented with it, I am thrilled, excited, but I absolutely have to scrutinize it to be 100% sure.
There's a document here from 1487, from the Lille archive.
Yanina studies a copy of the document on a tablet.
My initial excitement here is we're at first mention, Madame the Dowager.
Yeah,
so we're dealing with Margaret of Burgundy.
Yeah.
And then from then, this is sort of goosebumpy stuff. Serve her nephew, son of King Edward, who was expelled from his dominion. This seems to me to be not a forgery. If you're going to forge something, you might forge a diary, you might forge a letter, but a receipt is so sort of nuts and bolts, isn't it? This amount of money for this. Margaret is commissioning mercenaries to fight, to travel over that sea and launch an assault to take the crown.
I mean, is she going to spend all of this money on some random called Simnel who's been trained to pretend to be king? And
absolutely not.
You don't think so? So, as far as you're concerned, this provides significant evidence and probable cause to believe that the older of the princess in the tower was not murdered.
On the surface, having a look at it in translation, it's very compelling.
Yanina examines two more of the documents and gives her assessment.
The way that the seals have been attached with the double strips and the way it's cut through, that is all off the time. That all feels right to me.
There's just one more document to check.
This was my big wow moment. Mm. On the face of it, what it looks like is Richard, the younger of the princes of the tower, giving a full account over four pages of his life. It felt very much like a sort of witness statement. Mm. I am the real deal. Mm. Here's my story. And boy, is it a story.
But that is why my alarm bells are going off. It's almost too good to be true. I've worked with forgers before, and I know how a forger's mind worked. This, to me, is the sort of thing I'd be thinking, oh, I know what people would like. They would like a document that says all of these things. I just think it needs an awful lot more investigation.
Taking this in, Rob moves on.
It's really useful to spend time with an expert when you're trying to unpick things. And spending time with Yanina again was just limitlessly valuable. There's a big question mark over Richard's life story. In a nutshell, she thinks it's too good to be true. It could be a forgery. So I really need to investigate this document further to find out if it's kosher or if it's a fake.
The Princes in the Tower, the new evidence. London. Rob lays out copies of portraits and documents on a conference table.
Philippa's coming in and I've got to give her my opinion about all of the evidence she's shown me as she's dragged me halfway around Europe. Let's just be clear. Philippa has staked a lot on this document, Richard's life story. For her, in her words, this is a mind-blowing moment. And it may very well be compelling. Who wrote it? We don't know. It could have been an imposter. But if it's not from the time, it's a non-starter. And it's essential that if we're going to build a foundation of any conclusion, a safe one, the starting point is to be sure, absolutely sure, that this document was written at the time and not some fake. The first thing I'm going to do is call Irene at the Gelders Archive. I've asked her to conduct further research. What she says is absolutely critical.
Hello, it's Irene Roker.
Irene, it's Rob Rinder here.
Hi, good morning, Rob.
You've had a chance, I think, to conduct further analysis on the document that was discovered in the archive.
Yes, we have looked very closely at the manuscript. One of the experts at the Gelders Archive, he is a specialist in medieval documents, and he has seen every single document in this archive. It's from 1100 until 1500. you see a lot of similarities between the archive and the document from Richard.
So this person takes a view looking at that document that the writing style and the way it's written makes it look authentic.
It does, yes. The watermark on the document is another indication that it is definitely from the era, from the late 15th century.
Rob nods as he takes this on board.
So I've emailed you a copy of the watermark because you can't see it with the naked eye.
Ah, yeah, it's this hand here. And what does that watermark on this document tell us?
Well, this specific one was mostly used during the late 15th century, and it was used in this area.
So this watermark places us bang in the period we want, the end of the 1400s, and it looks like the same writing and the same style as other documents from the time. And in your view, this is an authentic document.
Yes. We are completely behind the authentication of the document.
Thank you very much. That's as clear as it can be. Thank you for that work.
Thank you.
The Gelders archive could not be more conclusive. But that's not enough. To shore up a case, you always want two experts. So I've asked Dr. Andrew Dunning, who's an expert on medieval manuscripts at the Bodleian Library in Oxford, to analyse the document as well. Let's see what he has to say.
Hello, Andrew Dunning.
Hi, it's Rob Rinder here. Andrew, can I ask what your conclusions are about the document you've analysed?
The document is completely what you'd expect of a late 15th century semi-formal legal document. It's the script of a trained scribe. It's a less formal style of a Gothic cursive script. And you can see that this document has been folded several times.
It's been folded?
Yes.
Why is that significant?
It's been folded into a neat little package. And that's often how documents were delivered. It's also how they were often stored in medieval and early modern archives. And so this document, although we don't know exactly where it came from, we can see that it has a multi-layered history nonetheless.
What about the choice of words and the punctuation, Andrew?
There is almost no punctuation whatsoever in the writing. The style of writing that you have here is completely consistent with what you'd expect of the 15th century.
If I were to put to you, Andrew, that this is a forgery, it's a fake, what would your response be?
If this were a forged document, this would be a work of sheer genius, and I think it's a possibility.
That's fascinating. Andrew, thank you for your time and also for the care you've taken with this document. It's enormously important.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure, yes.
I mean, wow. It's so rare you get an expert to be that definitive. It's not a forgery, but we don't know who wrote it. This could have been written by anybody. So what impact it has on my conclusion, that's for me to consider. Were the boys killed in the tower? Or could they be the people that Philippa has shown me? Kings or imposters, boys in the tower or not? I can't overstate how seriously I take this. If she's wrong, her reputation is at stake. If she's right, centuries worth of history is wrong. Just think about the impact of that. This is about as serious as history gets.
Stained glass windows and conical towers under a bright blue sky. Then a suited Philippa entering a cafe where steam spurts from the coffee machine as a drink is made.
I've come down to London today because I'm going to see Rob in his chambers and he's going to give me his conclusion. I'm off the scale anxious here because I'm going to walk into a room where I get Rob's conclusion. Which way is he going to go? Is the evidence as compelling that he's seen? Is it not? Is he going to go with the 500 years of Tudor propaganda?
Leaving the coffee shop, Philippa enters Rob's chambers. Then she's wringing her hands anxiously as she gazes out of a window.
There's kind of no going back. And I've just got to see what he's going to say.
Rob appears and they shake hands.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi.
Hi. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Do you come in? Off to you.
Thanks.
Take a seat. Get some water.
Please.
So, Philippa, at the heart of this case is whether Richard III murdered his nephews or not. The older one being Edward, the younger one being Richard, in order to gain the throne. Or could it be a missing person inquiry and they survived? I'm only interested in the evidence that supports whether or not he killed those boys or whether they may have escaped and come to invade England. What I'm going to give you now is a summary of what I consider to be the conclusion in this case. There are four documents that we stopped at during our zigzag across Europe. One of them is from the Lille archive, and it's a receipt that shows that Maximilian was providing an army for Edward, the older of the boys in the Tower, who was going to claim his throne in England. And I'm satisfied that that receipt is authentic and from the time. There are a further three documents that have been unearthed in respect of the younger of the boys in the Tower, Richard. From the Dresden Archive document, which is a contract promising if Richard succeeds in taking over the throne, he's going to pay that money back to Maximilian. And critically, it's got his signature on it. I'm satisfied that that is an authentic document. The Austrian Archive, which again is an account where somebody takes a note of marks that were on the body of Richard. I am, again, entirely satisfied that that is a document from the time. And lastly, a document from the Gelders Archive, and it's from a scribe, which may have been at the time, where a person purporting to be Richard gives a full narrative of his entire life. I, along with Yanina Ramirez, had grave doubts about that document. In fact, I want to be absolutely clear with you, I took the view that it was a fake. In 20 years of practice, I haven't ever been wrong about a piece of paper being unkosher, for want of a better way of putting it. I asked two independent experts, world-leading experts in their field. The bad news, I'm afraid.
He looks at Philippa across the table.
Is that I was entirely wrong. Both of those experts take the view that it was written precisely at the period that we are focusing in. And in no way whatsoever is it a forgery from a later date.
Wow. Wow. Thank you.
Now, based on the documents that you've provided me with, on the balance of probabilities, I'm satisfied that it is perfectly possible to challenge the traditional narrative. In fact, it seems to me it is highly plausible that Edward, the older of the boys in the Tower, survived. He was not killed in the Tower by Richard III. It seems to me more probable than not, but he lived and he fought at the Battle of Stoke. Where he may have died, we don't know. In respect of Richard, my view is even stronger. The material you've unearthed is more than sufficient to conclude that this was not a murder. That the person who came to be known in history as Perkin Warbeck was the younger of the boys in the Tower. Not only did Edward and Richard survive the Tower, but they lived. They continued to live on. They tried to invade England, that they failed. You, Philippa Langley, along with your team in Europe, may just have solved the greatest mystery in British history.
She beams.
Wow.
you.
Thank you.
Getting up, Rob hugs her.
Thank you. Thank you for doing this for me. Thank you. I'm shaking.
Do you know, that was big news. Heavens above, that was big news, because Rob is no idiot. He's tough. So I'm overjoyed. I'm thrilled. It's overwhelming, because we've had 500 years of this story being rolled out and repeated. We've changed that now. We've completely changed the conversation.
They say lightning doesn't strike twice, but in your case, it may have done. I've no doubt that Philippa's work is going to cause controversy. It's going to cause a ripple in the world. But the reality is, Philippa's account is more persuasive based on the evidence.
Your work continues, right?
It does.
See you soon.
See you.
Now, here's the exciting thing. I may be wrong, but that's not what this is about. One thing this trip has shown me more than anything else is that we should always question history. Who gets to write it and who's believed? What's fact and what's propaganda? History is for everybody. Now it's up to the rest of the world to see what they think.
The Union Jack flag fluttering atop the Tower of London.